leaders.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action, team reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy
Justice.
Of the obsessed.
We are continuing our conversation with our friends who are educator authors. I've got Carrie Randolph here with me out of Tulane, and we have a guest who many of our listeners know as a storyteller and interviewer extraordinaire, but they may be a little bit less familiar with your story, Shanna, as we have you on today as an author. So can you just start us off and let our listeners know a little bit more about you? What's been your path to the classroom?
I used to say this as a joke, but it really wasn't a joke. So I was a reporter before I was a teacher. I went to a career day at an elementary school, and the teacher there asked me like if I liked working with kids because she thought I was good with kids, and she said maybe you should go be a teacher. Then she asked me how much I made as a reporter. And when I told her, she like gasped and said, oh my God, you've got to become a teacher. You'll make $10,000 more than you're making now, which was true. When I went to teach, I got an immediate $10,000 raise. So if that tells you anything about how we valued print reporters in Amarillo, but it was really something that I had always wanted to do, and I avoided it because I didn't want to work that hard. I knew it was going to call on me to be a better person than I felt that I could be, and that it was going to break my heart the way that things that you truly love will do to you, and I didn't want to do that. 15 years in the classroom of all of that being true, I still wouldn't trade it for anything. And it is the best thing that I've ever done in my whole life.
Yeah, I'll add, Shannon and I often shared stories about how we got into the profession. I actually swore I'd never be a teacher, but really fell in love with teaching when I was getting my PhD in microbiology, which I left that program to teach. I was forced into a teaching assistantship, and I begged not to do it. And about day two into that role, fell in love with teaching and have never looked back. Because I was a scientist who came into the classroom, I really approached teaching science very differently than they did. They really approached it as a set of facts that you impart to kids and they can go forth and spew them all over the place. That's not the way I approached it at all. I really thought about how you train scientists instead of teach people science, because I think the process is so important. And there's way more science than we can teach kids anyway at this point. So how do we teach them to be critical consumers of information, ask great questions?
Shan, I wanted to jump in and ask you about your book, Think Like Socrates, for those of you who have not yet purchased it. And so one of the things that I was thinking about the entire time I was reading it was, as you were sharing, that you entered this profession from being a reporter. I really think about, like, is that the experience, or were there others that just made this question-based approach to education such a natural fit for you?
Oh, I think that's a good question. I don't think I've even thought about that. It was truly out of desperation that I thought to do that. I tied it to a real experience that I had as a reporter. We had a really terrible tragedy of a child that went missing from the neighborhood where I taught. So I knew these kids knew about it, and it's still unsolved to this day. In fact, they've kept up the same billboard in North Amarillo, and it's, you know, it's windblown and tattered, and there's his picture and no one's found him. And those kinds of stories are partly why I did choose to leave news and go into features writing, because features writing was about schools, which is what like put me in schools in the first place. It was because I couldn't handle the tragedy, and my children were about the same age as he was when he had disappeared. So I knew this was in my students' minds, and I don't remember what we were reading, or somehow that like he was brought up in class, and it just really rattled me. And I said, you know, that whole thing I'll never forget. In fact, I think about him all the time, and I have a question that can't be answered. And that's, yeah, why do good things happen to bad people? Because I know bad things happen to good people. That's the way of the world. But why do some people get away with things like that? It was the first time that there had ever been like that profound silence that every teacher knows when you have really struck a chord with your students, or you've really connected to them at a deep level. And I saw that with that question. That's when I thought, well, maybe they have similar questions. And if I make it anonymous, because they're seventh graders, they'll tell me these questions that they have. And they did. I couldn't wait to see what they had written on these index cards, where I just asked them to anonymously share the questions that they couldn't stop thinking about, and that maybe they hadn't even told people that they wondered about. And that was sort of the seed of it. And then I realized other educators, and that's why Carrie's in the book, other educators do a version of that same kind of inquiry. So my, I guess, theory or hypothesis, what can happen is that we could take that sort of questioning structure and help people if they had like expert or content master teachers sort of guide them in the natural inquiry that underlies every content area. And if they had trouble, you know, they could use this little system, that this little protocol that I thought up.
The thing that was so cool to me to be just have a minor role in talking with you about the book was the way that you questioned these content teachers, as you call them, these really dynamic teachers, and the way you got, I know when I was talking with you, I really felt like I was being interviewed, right? And you were pulling things out of me that I don't know that I had ever articulated in that way. And I think that's really present throughout the book from everyone. So I feel like it's not just the substance of the book, but it's the structure and the format too that really reflects that, those amazing skills, those mad skills that you have.
Thank you.
So Carrie kind of led into this whole, some of these parts of the ways that you interviewed and the ways that you started getting to a place where you had a book. One of the things that we're really exploring in this series here is that journey from educator to educator author. So like, how did you go from idea to publication? And what were those highs and lows along the way?
Oh, there are a lot of lows. It's hard. It is super hard to write a book, even if you enjoy writing, or if you consider yourself as a decent writer. It's hard work because there is nobody standing there by your keyboard when you're doing it going, yay, yay, Adam, way to go. You know, oh, you put down 1,000 words, way to go. It is such a lonely thing to do. So to me, that's one of the, I think, the hardest things that anybody that sets out to write anything needs to really accept about the process, is that it will require you cutting out consistent time by yourself to think things through. And I think the second thing, and this is where teaching really helped me, I mean, teaching taught me consistency, the value of consistency. Teaching also sort of gave me this idea of the nature of revision that's just sort of embedded in all of our practice, where we get a second chance. You know, maybe if first period crashes and burns, you get a second chance in second period. So what that meant for me when I translated that over to writing was I learned to tolerate my own writing that was so bad it made my teeth hurt. I mean, truly awful writing, because I knew I could come back to it and make it better, that the point was to just get it down. And I know there are tons of teachers who should be writing up, and just the unique way that they're approaching certain things that they do, or just stories. There's also that reckoning that you have to have, that to take it from the somebody saying, oh, you should write a book, to actually sitting down and doing it means that you do have to accept that it is hard work.
What about the publication side of things? So you have a manuscript, you're now dealing with editors and graphic designers. You got any good stories for us?
Well, you know this one. So you send your stuff off and it goes through this whole editing process and design process. And then they send you cover ideas. You know, that whole judge a book by its cover is really true. Like, there's real research on people buying a book based on what it looks like. And so they sent me this first couple of ideas, and they were just the ugliest thing I'd ever seen. I remember I had to ask Carrie, like, can you help me with the graceful, Southern, genteel way to tell them this is ugly as a mud rail fence and I hate it and I don't want it.
Yeah, I had, this was my initial thought. I was like, this is Shanna's book. Like, what are they doing? And it bothered me that, I mean, some of them were pretty atrocious. That she just couldn't come out and say it, that it was this bit of a dance. And Jen, I also remember you talking a little bit about just like word limits on certain parts and just mm-hmm. having to work with them on that kind of stuff as well. So, I mean, I think through you, I understood the publisher, it wasn't completely like off, you didn't have total freedom as the author, the format was restricted, you know, mm-hmm. and of course, if I remember correctly, they were using market research and what people use and don't mm-hmm. use, but how frustrating that must have
yeah.
been.
Well, I appreciate that. And I suppose that was, you know, years in a newsroom where people were not even nice about saying, you know, that your copy was terrible or the things that you wrote were terrible. The other thing is one of the designs that they sent, our colleague Mike Vea looked at for me, and he instantly said, because they'd done it like the Corinthian column that's in Greek architecture. And it was a cartoonish depiction of it. It was meant to look like a cartoon. But the first thing Mike said when he saw it was, oh, that looks bosomy. I at first didn't know, like, what did he mean? And I looked at it again and I was like, he's exactly right. It looks like bosoms. It looks like a Victorian woman's like bodice or whatever, like a bosomy thing. And I sent that to my editor and I said, here's the words of one of my colleagues. He says it looks bosomy. And she wrote me back and went, oh my gosh, that's exactly what it looks like. We will not be using that.
Feedback can go both ways. Because I'm guessing part of the challenge is like the people who are doing all of these steps haven't actually read your book.
No, I mean, but I will say this, the wonderful woman who designed the interior of the book, I love what she did with the interior. I think it's particularly beautiful. And the way she just sort of like designed each of the pages to be very useful and readable. She told me that, and I consider this to be one of the highest compliments I got from my publisher in any way. She said she would be looking over the proofs and she would get caught up in some of the stories that were in the book. And some of the things that, you know, some of the stories I told, some of the stories that other people told. And she said that that hadn't happened to her before because she usually did not didn't design books that had a narrative component like mine does. I thought that was high praise.
You write in Think Like Socrates that this book is for teachers who want something better for their students and who believe in each child's capacity for deep and creative thinking. How did you land that audience for the book?
That's a really hard question that you always have to ask yourself when you're approaching any kind of of creative task is, who is this for? And what am I trying to do with it? I took Barbara Kingsolver's advice. I mean, she's this brilliant novelist and essayist, but she's sort of my hero. She basically said, you know, write the book that you wanted to read. So much of that was written for the teacher that I was, that stood inside room 200 at Palo High School and needed people who believed in inquiry. And I am so fortunate to know such a wonderful group of like people who, even though we don't teach the same grade level, we don't teach the same content area, we're essentially the same person, because we approach teaching in the same way. In a way, I wrote it for myself, but I also wrote it because I wanted to highlight these fantastic practitioners and the way that they approached teaching math or teaching government or teaching fine arts in this same way that I was doing in my classroom.
A lot of these teacher storybooks can be a little navel-gazing or solipsistic. And I think one of the things that makes yours different, it's the story of so many teachers. You burned through an entire Rolodex. Like, how many people do you even know at this point? Like, how many different teachers are celebrated in those couple of hundred pages?
I want to say 25. Each area, each content area, like with Carrie's section in science, was it's her and my friend Craig Beals, who's a Montana Teacher of the Year and is a chemistry teacher. And then my friend and mentor, Jeff Charbonneau, who was the 2013 National Teacher of the Year and was a longtime science and robotics teacher in Washington State. And so you have these like three powerhouse teachers there in that science chapter. But then in other parts of the book, I've interviewed people like my friend Karen Vogelsang, who's from Tennessee, my friend Lion Terry, who taught elementary school. So I was able to call on all of these other people who may not be like the content specialist, but they're definitely represented.
One of the things I appreciated when I certainly like when I got the book the first time, I like went straight to the science chapter to read it because that's what I'll do in any book about teaching, but if it's there. But since have read the rest of it and had a conversation with a teacher that I used to mentor who had bought it, and I saw on Facebook that she'd bought it, and I was like, oh my gosh, she bought the book. And we had a short little conversation about it. One of the things I think sometimes when you involve 25 plus, I would say it's probably 25 plus, educators in the book, sometimes it ends up being a lot of great stories, but what can I take back and use right away? And that's not at all my experience with your book, Shanna. I mean, and I think that comes out in the response that you gave, that you wrote the book that you wanted. It's so interesting because as you were doing your great interview wonder on me when we were talking, I realized that I was almost giving you narrative around what I would tell me when I was the beginning, things I wish I knew when I started teaching. And I when I was talking to my friend who had bought the book, that was kind of what she said. We had a whole conversation just around how useful it was immediately and how it was something she returned back to. And I love that you have grades 4 through 12 on it. I remember you and I having a brief conversation about this. It's really like K through 16. It's really a way of approaching teaching in a way and thinking about it that I think is actually, I know your examples are probably 4 through 12. That's why you did that. But I think it's much broader than that. And I know a lot of university professors who need to read it too.
Well, when you call it 4 through 12, you can write the sequel that's pre-K through 3.
Oh, good point. And I am post-secondary. You can do that. Right.
Good and point. On the job.
This is why you guys are my friends, among many other reasons. You think of things I never see. I think teachers get bombarded with so much judgment and shame and blame, and they don't get the kind of nurturing. And I would also argue we, in many regards, we're not able to do that with students either for the same reason, because of all of this pressure, this external pressure. And so a lot of professional development and a lot of books for teachers feel very either preachy or judgy, or, you know, really set out to be like, this is what you should and should not do. And I wanted to value what I knew is in anybody that approaches teaching seriously, that I would hope that they would find something of use for their own practice and their own kids and their own classroom.
You know what I think is kind of remarkable about that? One of the things I also appreciated when you talked to me, I know you asked me these questions and it's in the book, but you didn't, sometimes in that world that you just described, which is a great world, accountability is, teachers are given this kind of moral question, like, do I do what I think I should do as a teacher, or do I think about test scores? And what I appreciated about your book is it isn't written outside of the reality that teachers face every day. In other words, people talk about, no, this is what I do because it's right for kids and my test scores are fine. It's written within the current reality in which teachers are living. And I think a lot of books that I've looked at either avoid the reality or like just say, well, it shouldn't be that way. And so this book isn't about that. So this is written for teachers because that is the world in which we live in K-12 public education or grades 4 through 12. It's practical on multiple levels.
That's a lot why I put the standards in the ends of every chapter too, because I worked under some pretty severe accountability teaching in a Title I school. We had a lot of it. It was my way of saying, look, you can do both things. And in fact, the more you teach kids to think like this, the more you're teaching them to think like the people who make the tests. And so they gain a real sort of intellectual confidence. And it's not scary. They can sort of get like what people want them to do because they've generated their own questions. And in fact, my mentor teacher, she tried this out a little bit. Questioning with her book club. So her senior, like dual credit kids, they generated their own questions and essentially wrote their own tests. So they wrote their own end of course tests. It was based on their questions. And she said, you know, that's better than, their questions are better than ones I would have asked and harder.
Would you be willing to read a favorite passage or a passage that took multiple tries to get right?
I can read the La Maestra. That one's a good one. So this is at the beginning of chapter 14, La Maestra. My first week of teaching was disastrous. I cried every day driving home and grabbed the phone to call my editor to beg for my job back at the newspaper more than once. The only job opening at the time was for a seventh grade writing teacher, and I took it with a kind of hubris that only a non-teacher would. Any delusions of being like a teacher in the movies were quickly dismantled by the realities of facing streetwise and suspicious 12-year-olds. About 2 months into daily ego erasures, courtesy of the boys sitting in the first seat on the first row, I ginned up my courage to make my first parent phone call to express concern about Juan. Juan, a jittery, hormonal, bored boy, spent his time drawing genitalia on his desk and ignoring our reading to work on writing love notes to the girl 2 rows over. During read-alouds, he coaxed other boys into wrestling and shadow boxing. When I asked most anything of him, he responded by rolling his eyes and making a sucking noise with his teeth. "Man, I hate this class," he said as he commenced to carving "you suck" into his desktop. "You suck." This critique, one I've thought of myself so many times, was enough to snap me out of the fear of calling his parents. With the school counselor's translation, I was able to detail all of Juan's crimes against my authority into vivid Spanish. His father is very upset and wants you to know that he will handle this, Olivia said, hanging up. And that was that, I believed. Nothing more would come of it. To soothe my still trembling self-image, I imagined some possible scenarios where Juan would have his Nintendo locked away or be made to mow every lawn on his block for free. The next day, I was surprised when he and his father came to my room after school. Juan's father stepped in, bent forward from stoop labor, his hands raw, his face lined from years of squinting. I was afraid that he had come to tell me that I was a fraud and to demand that his son be transferred to another class. But my defensiveness quickly dropped when he took off his snapback ball hat, speaking to me in the tones usually reserved for those in power. Miss Peoples, he began, I come to apologize for Juan's disrespect to you. He pulled Juan forward and looked at him. This lady is one you respect. This is La Maestra. She is teaching you so you don't be like me. You respect La Maestra and you apologize. La Maestra. I'd never heard the term before. He called me La Maestra, the teacher. Whether he knew it or not, Juan's father reversed all my resentment and self-pity. All I could do was respond by smiling and thanking him profusely. No, I thank you, he said. I stood staring at the door after they'd left, feeling my heart squeezing inside me. Juan's father gave me a title and an identity that I carry to this day as an honor, as a burden, as a responsibility, as a noble title, as a descriptor of my life's work.
So if anyone wants more of that, it's Think Like Socrates, available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. Is there a book two percolating?
Why do you hate me? Is that what it is? You just want me to be sad and chained to a keyboard.
I just figure you need a distraction from your dissertation. Writing something fun.
I have an idea of one that I really want to write, and I have pieces of it written. It's just a matter of like going back to the grind of getting up at 4:30 to write. To get it done, because that's what I have to do. That's my process. But I've wanted to write a book again, like we've been talking about, one that I would have wanted. And this one is not so much aimed at the head, but would be aimed at the heart. And I don't mean that in a gooey way. I mean in a real like teacher SEL way of how I kept myself at least teaching in really difficult conditions, and how people I know and admire, like my mentor, did it for 43 years. What are the things that people draw on to keep them in this profession that if you do it right, takes every single part of you?
How about you, Carrie? Has becoming a book put a book into you?
I have thought multiple times about writing a book. I don't know that I have a whole book, so I would just love to continue to support Shanna in her writing. No, I mean, I do think a lot about it. I think about it in terms of these days. I think about teacher leadership and teacher voice is something I think a lot about. And I think I've learned a lot about that over time, and in both me and not realizing the voice I had, but also trying to help others think about their voice and elevate it. I think it's desperately needed. But I would this is what I learned from Shanna. I would steal a page from Shanna and just really try to make it even more of a compilation of all the teachers I know and interviewing them and their words of wisdom. Because like Shanna, I think there's a lot of heart that's needed, or a lot of call to the heart that's needed. I'm happy to support Shanna in any book she has in any way in the future. It was it was a real pleasure to play even a really tiny role and watching it come to be.
Thank you for being in it, and thanks for what you're doing now, because I mean, you're at the beginnings of the pipeline that's so important to getting people to do this work that we all love.
Well, thank you, Carrie, and thank you, Shanna, for this has been another episode of Pedagogy of the Obsessed, summer edition. We look forward to having more to say to y'all in the fall.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, with the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a praxis of action and reflection on the world.